We've talked about this a decent amount this morning, and he's kind enough to join us now on short notice. He's a professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Justin Wolfers, professor, good morning. How you doing?
Morning. Doing well.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time. You know, we were really fascinated, not only when this study, when you released your study, but it really kind of became even more intriguing to us in the aftermath of the NBA providing you with their own statistical data that according to you and some other independent people have concluded kind of backs up what you were saying. And just so people have an understanding of what we're talking about, your study basically tried to expose what you think is racial bias in foul calls in the NBA. And this is not a one-year study. Give us a sense, Professor, of how long this took for you to put together.
So my co-author and I, Joe Price, we've been working on these data for probably a couple of years now. But we collected data on every foul call in the NBA back in the 91-92 season. So that's 600,000 foul calls. And a lot of the study's been missed or misrepresented a lot in the media. I'm sure not by you guys. But the point is not that, you know, we see systematic bias against black players or against white players. It's that when you examine an individual player through time, on nights for that one player, on nights in which more of the referees are of his race, he draws fewer fouls and scores more points. And so this suggests both that white referees are favoring white players and potentially that black referees are favoring black players.
You know, one thing that we were wondering, and I know that in the study, you couldn't, I don't think, identify the individual officials that were making these calls on a nightly basis, and if you could, correct me, but we obviously know that the percentages of white players to black players in the NBA is a staggering difference. Could you accurately then evaluate the white officials making these foul calls against black players by percentage were exponentially higher in the same on the other side with black officials to white players?
Yeah, so this is a key point, and I think this has been a key point of confusion. Lots of people have told me that, of course, there's more foul calls against blacks. There's more blacks in the NBA.
Right.
In fact, Charles Barkley made that point about 15 seconds before calling me a jackass.
I remember that.
Well, welcome to the club.
Barkley didn't call me a bad basketball player, just a bad economist. But this is the key issue is what we do is for each individual player, just take any individual in a season, we say, how many fouls did you get on nights when the refereeing crew was of your race? What about when the refereeing crew was of the other race? So it's comparison player by player. So it's not confounded in any way by the fact that my teammates may be white or my teammates may be black. That's obviously a factor we need to take account of, and we did. And, you know, it is an important factor. In our sample, about 4/5 of the playing time goes to African-American players, but only about 2/5 of the playing time is officiated by African-Americans. So there's a very big imbalance there. Now, let me go back. And you raised the question. In our study, we don't know who blew the whistle.
Right.
We have 600,000 foul calls over an enormously long time period. That's more foul calls than you guys have ever seen in your lives.
Sure.
Now, it is true. We don't know who blew the whistle. But by the same token, what we can do is do the same analysis, but just think about it. For an individual player, on nights in which all three referees are of your race versus nights in which all three referees are of the opposite race, and just confine ourselves to those comparisons, because then we don't know which referee blew the whistle, but by jingo, we know his or her race. And we still find the same results. But this is why what's happened in the last couple of days has been really interesting. So the NBA came out and blasted our study and claimed it was wrong. Again, David Stern didn't call me a bad basketball player either, just a bad economist. Now, they said that what they had was play-by-play data on who blew the whistle, and that their analysis refuted mine. And they said they had proof that I was wrong. They still haven't shared their data with me, but they have shared with me their analysis, the tables of regressions and coefficients and all the stuff we nerds love. It turns out their own analysis using their preferred data set, and I think their preferred data set is not necessarily the right one, it still finds evidence, statistically significant evidence, of own race bias, much as Joe Price and I originally said in our first research paper. So Stern and Litvin and the NBA PR machine have been literally misrepresenting their own evidence to the national audience. And I understand this. They have a business to defend, and they think about this as a business issue. Obviously, I'm a researcher and somewhat more interested in what's actually going on out there.
Now, you said the commissioner and Charles didn't call you this, but I'll ask you this. Justin, are you a bad basketball player?
I'm one of the worst you've ever seen.
Really? Horrible?
I'm Australian. I mean, yeah. Who was the last good Australian? Luke Longley, Andrew Gaze.
Yeah, and those are the only two we kind of know.
That's you just about named the Hall of Fame there.
I could be the third best Australian basketball player and still be rotten.
You just about named the Hall of Fame, I guess. Now, when you came up with this idea, was it you and Joe coming up with this idea together? What made you do this? What brought about the idea? What fostered this in your mind?
So I was talking to Joe one day and we were talking about possible ideas for research, and he actually mentioned this, so I want to give full credit to my co-author. Mm-hmm. But to give the context for why we both think this is an interesting question, you have to go back and think about the role that economists have played in trying to understand discrimination. And so maybe 50 years ago, economists have always been interested in trying to understand discrimination, and 50 years ago it might have been pretty easy, which is that one group just hated the other, and there were legal barriers, and, you know, this was, Jackie Robinson is a key moment in changing the history of sports. Now, fortunately, I think that form of discrimination is receding and may even be disappearing, but we still see differences in outcomes for blacks and whites, and we see them in different domains, and so increasingly psychologists, sociologists, economists, lawyers have come to think hard about what we think of as being unconscious bias, which mm-hmm. is, you know, well-intentioned people who really want to get the call right, but despite that, race somehow colors their evaluations. And so as social scientists, one of the best ways to try and explore issues like this is try and find the one domain where you think people have the strongest incentives and the best reasons and the best training not to display this bias. And in some sense, it's a compliment to the NBA that we decided to analyze NBA data, because our judgment is that relative to other people who have to do evaluations, like, you know, I'm a professor, I have to evaluate my students. You guys have to decide who to hire and fire at your radio station. Judges have to decide who to put away in jail. But relative to all those people, these guys are much more professional than the rest of us. They make thousands of calls. They get a huge amount of feedback. They're tremendous incentives to get the calls right. And if you talk to referees, they're incredibly motivated to get it right. And so given all of that, we thought if we find unconscious bias even among these guys, that potentially makes a more powerful argument for how pervasive this might be more generally in society.
Okay, I'm going to be semi-serious about this next question. And some of the other stuff that you teach and papers you've done, you're examining and highlighting the parallel between, let's say, betting on ball games, gambling on the ponies, and purchasing stock in the New York stock market. Okay, now seriously, which one of those three do I have the best shot at?
I could tell you who to bet on, but I'm not going to tell you. What underlies your comment, I think, is it's a fun time to be an economist. So economics is not the dry thing that you may have learned in college or high school. Economists are increasingly of the view that we have something interesting to say about betting, about the stock market, about discrimination, about basketball, about who gets married to who, about what causes crime. It's all interesting stuff, and it's one of the reasons I love my job.
Justin Wolfer is with us, professor at the Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania. And as far as the NBA goes, everybody wants to think that when a study comes out that it's agenda-driven, and you're making it very clear that this is just something that was of interest to you and your co-author. Are you disappointed by the position? You talked about the NBA saying they have a business to run. You understand that. But it doesn't mean that you're not disappointed with the way that they have disparaged your findings. Are you disappointed by the stance that the NBA has taken, because it doesn't appear that this is agenda-driven?
I'm very disappointed. There's a bunch of political issues out there in the world in which there's hack statisticians who lie with data in order to support some bad political view. And that, therefore, pollutes the whole enterprise of people who are genuinely interested in trying to understand what's going on in the world. And certainly many of my colleagues within the academy, within universities, are really just trying to understand what's going on in the world around us in the hope that that can inform a better, broader discussion about social phenomena like discrimination. I think that not only am I disappointed in the NBA's response, I also think it was strategically stupid. If I were Commissioner Stern, I would have looked at our findings and said, you know what, even the authors admit that these are quite subtle effects. By jingo, look how far we've come in sports. This is not the problems we had 50 years ago, and, you know, at best we find subtle problems, probably a lot less discrimination on the basketball court than trying to, say, hail a cab at midnight, and we'll work in the off-season to try to eliminate whatever bias remains. Instead, Stern's response was to pretend that what we said wasn't true, despite the fact his own analysis, in fact, agreed with ours. It's a response that, in some sense, is very successful because arcane statistics are arcane statistics, and it's very easy for him to convince bad sports writers that there's agendas here that just aren't there. But, you know, at the end of the day, this involves denying, you know, facts that may be interesting about the world and may speak to, you know, broader agendas. And that's the thing I find really disappointing.
You know, one of the things that you also looked at that we were talking about earlier was you wrote a, you published a paper, Point Shaving, Corruption in NCAA Basketball in the economic, in the American Economic Review, May of 06. And I want you to explain to us again, you gathered data from 44,120 NCAA games. That must mean you had, like, you obviously had the full court package in order to be able to watch all these games. How much of these 44,000 games did you watch?
So because I'm doing statistical analysis for that point shaving paper, I literally watched none of the games in the sample. And I want to be upfront about that.
Yeah.
Let me tell you why, though. For something like this, is a completely different research agenda.
Right.
But here, for some, it's in a sense some a contribution to trying to understand corruption. If you think about how corruption works, the people involved have every incentive to make it really hard for you to see. And so, in fact, the players who do point shaving, they don't just miss an obvious basket. What they do is they stand half a foot back in defense, and it makes it a whole lot easier to score over the top of them. So if they're good at what they do, no one should be able to see what they're doing with the naked eye. Watching the game tape shouldn't help. They've got every incentive to make it impossible for you to see it in the game tape. But it may be the case that if lots of people are doing this, this is going to leave statistical footprints in the data. And so what I mean by that is if I'm a team that's expected to win a game by 12 points, that's the Vegas spread, too often, because I want to win my bet, my team's going to win by 10 or 11 points. So one research strategy would be to watch every game in which a team that was a 12-point favorite won by 10 or 11 and see if you can figure out if a guy was standing half a foot back in defense. And the truth is you're not going to be able to. Another would be to say, let's take all the games where a team is a 12-point favorite and find out, is it true that too often they won by 10 or 11 rather than winning by 13 or 14? And so it's an emerging subfield in economics. Some people call it forensic economics. You may not be able to see it in the game tape, but sometimes you can see it in mountains of data. I think there's actually an analogy here between that and our NBA study. Lots of players have said they're not aware of racial bias in foul calling. I think that's completely true. I think it's completely fair. But they're certainly aware of referees who've made mistakes. The only step that they're missing is asking, is there a subtle correlation between which referees make mistakes against which players and what the racial compositions are? These are subtle effects. You need a lot of data to figure this out, and so it's probably not so surprising that sometimes we miss it.
Professor, you've probably been able to tell by now this is really quite an intelligent radio show you're on with right now. Now, I can play some sound cuts and stuff. I've got something here I want you to listen to, which will most certainly make you homesick, okay? Are you ready for this?
All right, mate.
Okay.
Play your didgeridoo,
oh,
blue.
One of my favorite songs, seriously.
Didgeridoo. All together now, tiny kangaroo down.
Does that take you back a little bit?
Well, Jingo, you nearly had me singing along, and I'll tell you that the most famous recording of that's by Rolf Harris.
Wow.
How about that?
How about that?
Now, the one thing that is fascinating to me about point shaving is when you talk about the subtle things that people would do that if they are on the corrupt side of this business is that wouldn't we know more if this was widespread, the number of people that, that may or may not be involved, even if it's a, only a couple people, you have one person who tips off the player who has to execute or not execute in order for the play to be made so that the shave can be executed. Don't you think over the course of time in all these games from 89 to 2005, we'd have more examples of people talk too much.
Yeah.
Don't you think we would have known more about this if it was, in fact, widespread?
Yes, but I think we do know more. So, first of all, we're all aware of what's happened at Toledo,
right.
What happened at Arizona State,
yep.
What happened in City College, New York in the 1950s. And I did a very careful study where, as background research for this point shaving paper, where we went back and literally found every press account or court account of a point shaving scandal. And they hit the press, you know, every 10 years. So we know it occurs sometimes. And then the question is, how often does it occur? Subsequent to the prior to this publication of that study, I also talked to some college basketball players. Not surprisingly, or perhaps surprisingly to you, they were aware of it occurring quite a bit. They thought it may be quite widespread. I had a student I talked to only 2 weeks ago telling me that he thought that we were exactly accurate. But there's also another way you can get at this through research. Again, the difficulty is that these guys don't want to be caught. And so, you know, you could go and ask a bunch of college basketball players, did you ever point shave? And I'm pretty sure you know the answer to that survey. It's going to be no. The NCAA does something even cleverer than that, though. What they do is they field surveys where they say, are you aware of anyone point shaving or manipulating the outcomes to please gamblers? And the results of their studies actually turn out to be remarkably similar to mine. So even that alternative, it's a very different approach, asking people if they're aware of teammates or opponents mm-hmm. who've done this. But it yields evidence that potentially some of this is occurring. And I should say, I think the NCAA agrees with me on this, in that they spend a lot of money and a lot of resources trying to convince their college players to stay out of gambling. Why would they do that?
Yep.
No, presumably because they're worried about this. And I think the NCAA, to their great credit, take a very responsible attitude around this.
By the way, one of the classes that I believe you teach is finance, behavioral economics, and sports betting. Is that your most popular class?
I will say the students enjoy it, but I also enjoy it too.
I bet
really?
You do.
Keep gambling.
That's a tenet here on this program for a lot of people who listen. Hey, listen, it really is interesting to hear your point of view and to hear you expound upon things that I know have been talked about by a lot of people and squashed by people who don't want to talk about it. And I think you know what I mean by that. But we do appreciate your time.
I'm happy to have had the opportunity.
Thanks very much, Professor.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, Justin Wolfers, Professor of Economics at the Wharton School, the University of Pennsylvania.